This is lecture 17. The last time we were together, we were talking about doing the path integral for the harmonic oscillator. Outside coefficient, we had an omega squared x squared of t inside dt. We're integrating. Normally we integrate t prime to t double prime. Let me just do it today, 0 to capital T, to give you a variation on that theme. Dx, normalization, and then this will be the associated propagator x double prime of cap t, x prime at cap at time 0. We had agreed on the basis of our discussion about general quadratic integrals that this is equal to e to the I over h bar extremal value of action. Observe that this is the classical Lagrangian involved, and the integral here of 0 to t is the classical action. So we solve that equation of motion, find what that is, and plug it in, and that will be our extremal, and then we figure out what the proper amplitude factor is from that. The equation of motion appropriate to a harmonic oscillator is given by this equation. It involves sines and cosines. Our solution of interest is x double prime sine of t minus t plus x prime, that's wrong, that's the other way around, that's just saying sine t, x prime sine of t minus t, times an omega in here, all divided by sine cap t omega. So this has the feature that at t equal to 0, that's out, that becomes sine cap t over omega, that cancels that, gives us x prime. At t equal to cap t, that's out, that becomes cap t, that divides out and gives me x double. To evaluate m over 2 x dot squared minus omega squared x squared dt, it is convenient to integrate by parts. It can be m over 2 x, x dot between upper and lower, minus m over 2 x double dot plus omega squared x times x itself dt. So the evaluation of the quantity of interest to us can be given by the left-hand side. It's easier if we use the right-hand side, because here, the second term, by way of the equation of motion, simply vanishes. And all we have to do is evaluate this expression at the upper limit t, cap t, and the lower limit 0. To do that, I need to find what the time derivative of this expression is, and that's pretty straightforward. That gives me x double prime cosine t omega minus x prime cosine cap t minus little t omega, with an overall factor of omega in front and divided by the sine of t omega. Now we're ready to plug in these two quantities in here. So that's m of 2 x at cap t times the derivative at cap t minus x at time 0 x derivative at time 0. Well, in fact, x at time t is nothing but x double prime. So we have this expression, and x at time 0 is what we call the x prime. So we only have one thing to really worry about, and that's the velocity part. And let's figure that out. So that's x double prime times this derivative here, evaluated at cap t. At t equal to cap t, that's cosine of 0, and that's cosine. So that's times x double prime cosine of cap t omega minus x prime, all divided by sine cap t omega. That takes care of that first term. Here's the second term, x prime. And now we evaluate the same quantity at t equal to 0. That gives me x double prime from the first term minus cosine, minus x prime cosine cap t omega, all divided by sine cap t omega, close square bracket. And we have evaluated that. Let's simplify it a little bit. That's m over 2 sine cap t omega, that's in common. And then we have upstairs, we have x double prime squared, that takes care of that term. We have x plus x prime squared, that takes care of that term, all times cosine cap t omega, that takes care of that. Now we have minus x prime, x double prime, that comes in twice, so we have 2 x double x prime. So our evaluation for the exponent, d to the I m with 2 h bar sine cap t omega x double prime squared plus x prime squared cosine cap t omega minus 2 x double prime x prime. Beg your pardon. You're absolutely right. We forgot this extra omega. Extra omega sits in there. Thank you so much. And I need that. Was that your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. So this quantity is our evaluation, S. I use the symbol capital I for action, integral of Lagrangian, x comma x dot dt, when the action is generic. That is to say, when the x function involved, x and xt, are quite arbitrary. If I have chosen the extremal value, if I have solved the problem, and I now evaluate it for the particular exact solution, then I give that another name. I call that capital S, implying that it has, in fact, been evaluated here. It's no longer a functional of a path, because the path has only depends on its initial and final points. So this becomes a function of the two points, the initial and final point. So my action here, S, depends on these two initial points. Our amplitude factor in front, A, was square root I second derivative of S with respect to X double and X prime, and divide by 2 pi part. I'm going to prove that for you in just a moment. Let's use it right now in our particular case. So I want to take the derivative of this expression to figure out this second derivative right here. This is perhaps another way of writing it, which is a little more convenient. Only this term will contribute, because that's the one that has a non-vanishing term if I take a derivative with respect to x prime and x double prime. And in fact, I do that right there, and I get minus m omega over sine cap t omega. See, this minus 2 kills that 2, gives me a minus sign. Two derivatives, one of those each goes away, m omega over sine t omega. And so putting this in here gives me my amplitude factor. I use the minus sign to draw the I downstairs, 2 pi I h bar sine cap t omega. That is indeed the expression for the propagator, for the harmonic oscillator, for the indicated parametric choice. Okay, let's spend a minute. We're going to come back to analyze that, but I think it's time that I justified my choice for this S, for the amplitude factor. Okay. have seen before one of our general criteria for this function, what we took as complex conjugate. That was the same as the original function with interchanged arguments and interchanged time, or rather with a minus value for the time. So we can use this fact for ourselves to get a property of our function capital S. Our approximate answer, our answer for this expression k, is equal to some amplitude factor times e to the I h bar s of x double x prime. I'm not focusing on the time dependence of that. There is a time dependence right here. There's a cosine of cap t, and there's a sine of cap t down here. I'm focusing on the dependence on x prime and x double prime. So if I interchange those two positions with each other based on this property and merely from its self-evident form, I want to claim that that is invariant under that transformation. It's the same. Okay, the complex conjugation here, which would change that I to minus I, is rectified by the change of time t to minus t, which would pick up a minus sign from that sine function. Okay, this is the only thing I want to use right now. So here's our story. I want to propagate from time 0 up to time capital T. Let's call it from x to y. And then I want to propagate back from y to z at time 0. We've called these x prime and x double prime before. This will just save some of the indices, right? So what I'm doing is I'm propagating forward, so I have an s from y and x, that's my initial and final situation. Up here, I take the complex conjugate, because I'm going backwards in time, from from z back to y. But this is invariant under the interchange. I've just shown that. So I want to go from y to z, and plus I s y to x. I have an amplitude factor in front for this guy, and I have the amplitude complex conjugation back here. The amplitude may depend on the arguments. In fact, it will, for complicated problems, depend on the arguments. But this one, if you're dealing with stationary phase approximations, which we haven't come to yet, when h bar is a very small parameter, this will be slowly varying with respect to those, and you can set a and a star equal to each other. In our case, a and a star will be constants. It will not even depend on the variables. So there's no question of whether this guy depends on the argument t and y and z, etc. Anyway, we're dealing with something which is absolute a squared here. I want to integrate over the y variable. That's my intermediate situation. And I want to recover a delta function, which is x minus z. How do I pull out of this an a squared? That's a nice trick. I learned this from a chemist, William Miller, Jr. Okay. Since this is, in our particular case, this is going to work for all h-bar, it works for small h-bar. And for small h-bar, I can pretend that this is like a stationary phase or like a large expression, what's another name, steepest descent kind of argument, where there's rapid variation in the exponent. So what I'm going to do is the following. I'm going to take s up there, I have y, I'm going to replace that second argument by z, call it x. Oh, that's a big mistake. So I must put in a correction, which is z minus x. And then I go I s over h bar y and x dy, unknown a squared, integral should be a delta function. Okay, now I make a Taylor series expansion in this term. E to the minus s over h bar y comma x plus derivative s, we'll call it ds, here's h bar, ds dx, second argument, y comma x times the little change, which is z minus x plus I s y comma x divided by h bar dy. Well, those two terms cancel, so I'm left with a squared e to the minus I over h bar ds dx of y comma x times z minus x dy should equal delta of x minus z. Okay, well, what integral do we know that actually leads to a delta function? We know that e to the I k times z minus x dk divided by 2 pi, if I have an h bar, I'll put it in here, h bar, equals delta of x minus z. So I would like this combination, dy times absolute a squared, to play the role of the differential of that thing. So I want d, with respect to y, ds dx, which is the thing which is playing the role of k upstairs, d of that equal to, well, what's that going to equal? That's going to equal d, the second derivative, ds dy dx. That's going to equal my absolute a squared term. But I made a blunder. I have to have my 2 pi h bar. So that means okay, well, my 2 pi h bar here. So one more time. This is playing the role of the dk over 2 pi h bar. Well, what is that? That is the derivative here. Maybe you can make it consistent with the d, then that should be a dy. And that's equal to a squared dy, which is what I have to deal with. And so that means I can isolate my a squared as that. So a is the square root of that. D second of s, now I'll put back the original names, namely the initial and final points, 1 over 2 pi h bar. And the only thing this argument doesn't give me is the phase factor. And that phase factor I here, you get by looking at soluble problems. So that's a way to derive this amplitude factor that we've been talking about. Okay, any questions about that? Now let's return to our answer for the harmonic oscillator.
But for the harmonic oscillator problem, we did not show explicitly that the saddle point approximation is the right one.
So the question is, we did not show that the saddle point approximation is the correct one for the harmonic oscillator. The beautiful thing about quadratic problems is that saddle point approximation is the same as the exact problem. So that's why our extremal evaluation, which was a saddle point-like idea, turned out to be a proper, correct evaluation, as if we had integrated over all the paths.
No, but in free particle case, we explicitly showed that.
For the free particle case, we did it, but for the free particle case, the same argument would have worked. I wanted to give you a different flavor along the way. Okay. Let's talk about eigenfunctions and eigenvalues.
I have a question.
Yes?
Going back to that one, isn't there a phase factor going in the A?
What, one more time?
That equation, the last question that you wrote, that you were trying to explain why.
Yes, yeah, the I.
E to the I, there is a factor because you have a complex number to the
square. In fact, I put my I in the wrong place. The I is upstairs. I got a minus from the other thing, which brought it down. So now your question?
In the previous equation.
Yes.
Technically, there is a complex factor e to the I gamma that should appear because you have a squared number. Does that play a role?
Well, I have chosen that gamma, e to the I gamma, you're absolutely right, is the unknown phase, and I've chosen that to be square root of I.
Okay. It's a choice.
It's a choice, but it's the kind of choice you can get by saying that I want a real answer in certain cases. We talked about the transition from t goes to minus I to I minus I t, which takes this form into a strictly real form. X dot squared of t plus omega squared x of t squared dt dx m over 2. The I is gone, the h bar is still there if you want to keep it, things like that. So everything is real and positive. In that particular case, I can get that by letting the t in my solution here go to minus I cap t. What does that happen? That changes the cosine into a cosh. It changes this sine of t into a minus sinh of t, but then the times an I, and the i's cancel, and I get a net minus. So I get a minus m omega over 2h sinh cap t omega. And that minus sign means everything is damping, it's fine and falling off. Down here, it becomes a minus I sinh, and that minus I kills that plus I to give me an overall positive real coefficient. And that is the determination by taking one example to get the sign correct. If Andy, if you moved over one, then these two people could sit down.
Okay.
Eigenfunctions and eigenvalues. All the erasers are...
Is that it?
Okay, we have determined, in this case for the harmonic oscillator, the propagator, which has a representation in terms of rockets and operators in this way from the quantum mechanical point of view. This operator H, as we know from the harmonic oscillator, has a collection of eigenvectors with eigenvalues which would be H bar, omega, well, let's just call them En. You know what they are. So I can take this expression and put in, now the equality sign jumps a line, I can put in a sum over the complete resolution into these eigenvector states. This operator now sees an eigenvector and gives me an eigenfunction. And I can write those then as phi sub n of x double prime, phi sub n of x prime complex conjugate, times e to the minus I t energy level divided by h bar. And this is all information contained within the propagator. If I look carefully enough, and this sum runs from n equals 0 to infinity, if I look carefully enough at the time dependence of this expression, I can pick out various coefficients here, which would then be the eigenfunctions. In particular, it even becomes a little bit easier to do if I make this rotation, t goes to minus I capital T. The only place it appears now is right here, and minus I quantity squared is minus 1. So that would become, after this rotation, that quantity would become phi n of x double prime, phi n of x prime complex conjugate, e to the minus t capital En over h bar. Notice that these things have not depended on the time whatsoever. And so they are unchanged at all by this complex change. Let me, in fact, use the very expression that we were building over here, m omega 2 pi h bar sinh t of omega e to the minus m omega over 2 h bar sinh t of omega x double prime squared plus x prime squared all times hyperbolic cosine t omega minus 2 minus 2 x double prime x prime.
And let's make life simple for ourselves and only look for the lowest level situation.
So I'm going to let t omega tend toward infinity, or if you like, capital, the omega is fixed, so it gets capital T is tending toward infinity. As capital T goes to infinity, I'm focusing on the lowest level energies to this problem. Indeed, the least of these, the ground state, can be obtained as follows. Since, as you remember, T omega is e to the plus T omega minus e to the minus T omega all divided by 2, while the hyperbolic cosine has the plus sign in between. So when T becomes large, only the first term is dominant, that's e to the t omega divided by 2. That 2 divided here cancels that 2, gives me an e to the t omega, which is in the denominator, and it becomes an e to the minus t omega divided by 2. The divide by 2 comes from the square root. Coefficient in front becomes m omega over pi h bar, the 2 being canceled. Up in the numerator, up in the exponent, rather, we have m omega 2 h bar. We have cosh divided by sinh. Well, that becomes unity as tanh, that hyperbolic tanh. No, inverse tanh, whatever. And it becomes unity as t gets huge. And so I pick up x double prime squared plus x prime squared. This term gets killed because that's divided by the sinh. That would come in a higher order. We're not interested in that. And so this is my expression for this term times the ground state energy. So I read off the ground state energy as h bar omega divided by 2. Notice that there is an h bar here and an h bar here, which you didn't really see before. And the ground state then borrows the square root of that factor. So that's m omega pi h bar to the 1/4 e to the minus m omega over 2 h bar x. So we have been able to straight away pull out of the propagator the first eigenfunction with quite some ease. Once you've done that, you subtract that and then try to go for the higher ones if you're so inclined. Okay. Now it's time to try to justify or at least find the proper limitations thereof of the original Feynman proposal. I'm not talking about the formal Feynman expression, e to the I by h bar m over 2 x dot squared dt minus potential dt. That is fraught with difficulty by itself. What I'm talking about is his lattice space approximation to that. As I reminded you or told you at the time, Feynman told us we could represent this by means of making a Riemann sum approximation to the integrals upstairs. Sum from L equals 0 to capital N, product dx L 1 to capital N, and then I forget them. It's like 2 pi I h bar epsilon m to the 1/2, but then there's n plus 1 of those. I think that's approximately right. And take the limit of this expression. As n goes to infinity, epsilon going to 0, and the product n plus 1, as I do it, epsilon equals the time separation, 0 to t. That is to be our definition of the propagator. We've worked that out following that rule for the free particle in the harmonic oscillator. The question is, can we justify this from what we know and love about quantum mechanics? And when I mean say that, I really mean it in a
And what I mean by that is the operator theory.
Is the what?
Operator theory. That quantum mechanics works in Hilbert space and there are operators, et cetera, et cetera. Can we actually derive this formula from those operators? And in so doing, can we find a condition on the potentials which will tell us when that prescription should work? And the answer is yes, we will be able to do that, and we'll find a limitation, and I'll illustrate cases where it fails. Okay, so here's the procedure. We start with Schrodinger's equation. H psi, and our H's will be limited to the two form P squared over 2m plus V of Q variety. This is indeed a limitation on possible Hamiltonians, and we'll shortly come back to try to find a formalism which overcomes that. The solution to this equation is e to the minus I capital T times P squared over 2 plus V of Q divided by H bar acting on psi X double prime. That would be the wave function at the future time. And I can put in my resolution of unity. Among the Schrodinger eigenstates to find a representation of this at an earlier time where there was no time forward propagation. So this quantity in here then becomes our, as we've seen in expressions like this previously, this becomes our kernel of interest, our propagator. Let us take the operator, e to the it, p squared over 2, m, I probably am slipping my m often. Question?
No, plus it.
Plus v. I'm going to break that into many small steps. But not with the same exponent. Yes.
Does the word, does the definition of kernel imply an inverse?
No. The function kernel, so the question is, does a kernel imply an inverse? So dyx psi of x dx leads me to new functions, works perfectly well for the kernel, which is identically zero everywhere. Okay, so I do this many times. In fact, I like to do it n plus 1 times. But I have I bring in my states, my initial and my final states on this fellow. And I put in a resolution of unity every pair. So that's x1, I integrate dx1. And here's another pair. That's xn. You know, I integrate all those from 1 up to capital N.
How can you do this when P and T, V are not commute?
Right. So, you're absolutely right. My guess at this point is that I'm making an error of order epsilon. So, she's asking a very valuable question. E to the minus I epsilon P squared over 2m plus V, which would be the natural thing if I just took short time steps of themselves, I'm approximating by putting those into separate exponents and paying the price
of the fact that they don't commute. And that leading commutator is the commutator between these two expressions and includes two epsilon, so the leading commutator is of order epsilon squared. So I would claim that the approximation that I'm making for each time step is of order epsilon, and since there are n plus 1 time steps, I'm making this kind of error, which is of order t times epsilon, or just a point of order epsilon, that's the term I'm estimating over here. We will exactly ask this question in a moment. Under what conditions is this valid? So now I have several integrals to do. In fact, I can write that in a more compact way by saying that that is pi product L equals 0 to n x L plus 1 e to the minus I epsilon p squared over 2m with an h bar, I guess. Gee, we haven't been doing very well always with the h bars. Times e to the minus I epsilon h bar over h bar v of q times xl. And in this definition, I have x0, which is x prime, and I have introduced xn plus 1, which is my final point, x double. Then to go along with that, I have my product k equals 1 to capital N dxk plus my prospective error term. So I'm interested in finding these individual matrix elements. The first one is easy because q is a coordinate operator. It sees an eigenvector and replaces that self with its eigenvalue. So that becomes product of the xl plus 1s e to the minus I epsilon p squared over 2m h bar xl times e to the minus I epsilon h bar v of xl. That's product l equals 0 to cap n times product l equals 1 to cap n dxl plus my error term. Okay, well, now I want to evaluate this.
But we've already done that. That's the free particle.
All that is the free particle. And we know the answer to that. So that answer is wa m over 2 pi I epsilon h bar square root for each degree of free each time minus I epsilon, no, minus plus I m over 2 xl plus 1 minus xl quantity squared divided by epsilon and h bar. And then we get minus I epsilon over h bar v of xl. That's for each of those. And now take the product of that. Again, product L equals 1 to n. I still have my integrations to do. K equal that. Order error. But now I've made the integrand explicit. So that becomes m over 2 pi I epsilon h bar n plus 1 divided by 2 and e to the I m over 2 let me put the sum outside, I over h bar summation l equals 0 capital N m over 2 xl plus 1 minus xl quantity squared divided by epsilon minus epsilon v of xl product k, let's call it L this time, L equals 1 to capital N, xl plus error. And if I tell you that I'm going to take this in the limit, as n goes to infinity, epsilon goes to 0, and n plus 1 epsilon equals 2 time, then that error should disappear, and this should be a reconstruction of the desired propagator. Only two things would mar this from being a proof. One is the integrals don't formally converge because they are purely oscillatory. Well, we always imagine our little extra term minus epsilon circle summation xl squared over 2, why not? And we take a limit as epsilon circle goes to 0 at the end. That's the, since we've used up epsilon, my little, my, I have to use another, and epsilon is the only small Greek number I know, then delta I don't want to use because that's just a note, right? So I use that. Okay, so that's understood. That's fine. Okay, what's the other condition? The other condition is, when is it true that this business works? When is it true? When is it true? Or what are the conditions? Put it more bluntly. So, given A and B as self-adjoint operators, I will give you a little story about that. Then, when does e to the minus I t over n a, e to the minus I t over n b raised to the nth power limit as n goes to infinity equal e to the minus I t a plus b?
To physicists, I would say this looks pretty obvious and straightforward.
The conditions are that we have a domain for A. A is a self-adjoint operator. If it's an unbounded operator, it cannot see the entire Hilbert space. If it cannot see the entire Hilbert space, it works on a subset of vectors called the domain on which it can act. A plus B is defined on certain vectors. Which vectors? A vector for which A can see that and for which B can see that. That's the only conceivable way in which you can say that that plus in the middle means something. A has to see, be able to see that vector and keep it in Hilbert space. B has to be able to keep it in that. So the domain of this situation is the domain intersection, the common domain between A and B. Those are the vectors on which A plus B is defined. So domain of A, and I've given you that A is self-adjoint. So domain of A and self-adjoint means that it generates a unitary transformation.
Okay,
so I need that the domain of A intersect domain of B, here's a technical word, I'll write it and then I'll explain it, is a core for A plus B. Core means that this is a rich enough set of vectors for this to define a unique self-adjoint operator, a unique generator of unitary transformations. That makes sense. How could I expect this thing, this construction, to limit to something unique if there was not a unique answer to it? And I'm going to give you just an example like that. So what's an example for which, and this is a theorem, and this theorem is called the Trotter product formula. Over the years, it's gotten another name due to Kato-Trotter product formula, because Mr. Kato came along and found a little error in Trotter's approach. But Trotter had the real ideas. Okay, so what's an example that works and doesn't work? If I'm interested in this final product. So A is equal to P squared over 2M and B is Q to the fourth. then this one is unique. For that sum, the answer is unique. That means domain of A, domain of B is a core. Now I change it. I make that a minus sign. P squared over 2m minus q to the fourth. The domains haven't changed. The domain of q to the fourth is the same as minus q to the fourth. That's trivial. So this is still the same domain for which this information is being allowed. But this guy is not unique. He has many different unitary possibilities given only this much information. I'm going to give you an argument of that right now, almost. Okay, so doesn't work. This whole construction fails for this guy. Suppose I didn't know that. Suppose I went ahead and nevertheless calculated this integral and took the limit in the case where v was minus x to the fourth. What would I get? Do I get anything? Yes, I do. But I do not get a unitary translation. The kernel I get does not represent a norm-preserving transformation. What is happening here?
I'm sighing only because we need 12 more minutes and you won't give it to me. So. Let's rapidly look at p squared over 2 plus q to the 4th as a classical Hamiltonian. You know that p becomes q dot. Q squared over 2 plus q to the 4th, Hamiltonian is conserved, so that's the energy. So I can solve for q dot. That's E minus q to the 4th all times 2 square root. And that means I can integrate that dq divided by 2e minus q to the 4th equals dt, integral. That gives me the equation of motion. Inverted, of course, unfortunately. T as a function of q, but there it is. And you know what that does. If I'm plotting t this way and q that way, that thing would oscillate back and forth, kind of like a harmonic oscillator, although it's not very harmonic. It has a q to the 4th. It's confined. The energy won't let it go very far. No problem. What about the other guy? I changed the sign of q. So q dot is equal to 2 times e plus q to the 4th. All I'm doing is changing the sign of the q to the 4th here and therefore here. So my integral is dq over 2 e plus q to the 4th square root dt. Okay, now let's follow that up. Here I am. T and Q and Q axis. And I have a point here and I have a little head start. I'm going that way. And I compute the integral. So I have a Q 0 and a T 0 for my initial point. Now what happens? As this gets larger and larger Q, I'm testing a convergent integral. This is dq over for large Q. That's like a square root of q to the 4th. That's like a q squared. Dq over q squared converges at infinity. I can put an infinity up here. And I've only got a finite number. So there's a finite amount of time that it took for the particle to reach infinity. That's what happens in the classical theory. In the classical theory, you might like to say, well, the party is over. Huh? The game is over. I hit a singularity or something. But you might also say, I'm going to send the particle back in. And it's going to go zipping off and come out the other side, for example. And then that guy says, hey, come on, let's play catch. And he sends it back in, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Well, what this means is the particle has reached the boundary in a finite amount of time. That is qualitatively no different than a square well. The particle meets the boundary in a finite time. Then you've got to decide what to do with it. Boundary conditions is called.
Do I make it so that it comes back the other side as a possibility? Do I let it bounce here? Do I make it some combination? Dirichlet, Neumann, all that stuff. So when you say p squared over 2 minus q to the fourth, you have not specified the Hamiltonian, because you haven't given me the proper boundary conditions at infinity, which this particle will explore in a finite amount of time. So what happens over here when you do this integral without that knowledge? You just do it. You put in a change of sign, x to the fourth here, and you run that through your giant QTP computer. Crank, 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 crunch, crunch, it gets something out. It will lose probability. Probability will be lost, because that's the best this equation can do. It says, you send particles to infinity, and I don't know what to do with them, so I'm going to keep them. So you're losing probability, and that will decrease monotonically down. And that's not what we want our quantum mechanics to do. We want it to have a unitary propagation. We want it to preserve probability. Therefore, we want to deal with true self-adjoint Hamiltonians. Self-adjoint ones are the ones that make unitary transformations, and our construction here has not led to a unitary transformation.
So if we restrict our Hilbert space to a smaller one, then would it solve the problem?
If the Hilbert space is finite, then all of this would not happen. I agree. But, you know, it's no fun at all that way. Let me just illustrate for you a sequence of unitary operators which converge to a non-unitary. Now, maybe that's self-evident to you, but we'll take it this way. This is cosine of theta, sine of theta, minus sine of theta, times cosine of theta, and this is an n by n matrix. But we're in an infinite dimensional Hilbert space, so I have ones all the rest of the diagonal. So I tell you, un vector psi, vector phi, and I take the limit as n goes to infinity. Individually, these are each unitary operators. That is true over here. Probability is not lost until you take the limit n to infinity. So over here, what's happening? The block here is getting larger and larger, and eventually the only block that counts is this one, times which is cosine theta times the identity. And so what you get out of that is that expression. So since this number is less than 1, you have lost amplitude. You have lost probability.
Thanks to you for your gracious attention for a few more minutes than normal.